Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Hello, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of the Center of Everywhere. On this episode, I talked to my research colleague, Marnie Werner, to discuss her newest research report coming out in February on the rising values of ag lands in rural Minnesota and the increasing dependence of our rural counties on property taxes from these lands. We discuss the disconnect between the value of ag land and farm profitability, the increasing role investors and non-farmers are having in this issue, and whether we should be worried about our rural counties who have a disproportionate amount of their revenue coming from one type of property, particularly ag lands. So Marnie, we've been working on looking at ag land, the value of ag land and the revenue generated through property taxes for our counties and school districts and things like that. And we've been looking at this for probably a year now. Right. And I'm curious, how did we get here? Like, why did we start this project again? Do you remember what were we being told by legislators? And I feel like maybe some of our board members and stuff like that, why this particular topic was important.
Yeah, sure. Well, it was probably, 5 years or more ago that people started just kind of mentioning to us, ag land is really getting expensive. And of course, it was hard to miss back, during 2012, 2013, 2014, when prices were getting into, record territory of $8,000, $10,000, $12,000 an acre. This was like ultimate highs that people had never seen before. And so I think part of it was just, wow, this is getting really expensive. Who can actually afford this? And we just come through the Great Recession, which, a big component of that had been an out of control housing bubble. And so, ag land was starting to look pretty bubbly too, just as we were coming out of the recession. And so I think people were getting concerned because especially people who were old enough and remembered the farm crisis of the 1980s, that had been preceded by a pretty big ag land bubble that resulted in just a catastrophic crash in ag land values and ended up bankrupting, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of farmers across the country. And I think that made a huge impression on people who lived through it. And so now they were just getting concerned. And so we, of course, were thinking, if ag land values are getting that high, what's that doing to property taxes? And as a result, local government revenues, which depend on property taxes.
Yeah, and before we dive too much deeper into the county revenue side of things, I want to stick to the land values. Looking at the data, it was really easy to see, starting kind of in 2008 through 2014, we were in a Great Recession. The Great Recession was happening, like you said, due to the housing bubble and the kind of financial sector in general just being a mess. But ag was doing pretty good, or I should say the farm economy was booming at this point, right? They were having record net income. And so it made a lot of sense to see land value at the same time go up. I think what's been kind of interesting for a lot of folks is that the farm economy is always up and down, and it's really been on a roller coaster ride over the last, I would say, now 10 years now, probably 10 to 8 years. They've had some pretty big downs. They haven't gotten back to the highs that they had during the Great Recession, but there's been some up and down. But land values have stayed either pretty flat from their initial increase or are still increasing a bit. I think even over the last year, we've been hearing anecdotal evidence that there's farmland going between $12,000 and $14,000 an acre at a time when the farm economy, isn't rosy right now. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense as to why there is a bit of a disconnect between the farm economy and ag land values?
Yeah, and I even found this in the research. Before basically 2008, it was pretty well established that the value of ag land was tied to the profitability of the product or what the land was used for. So if an operator was, you know, growing corn and getting a decent price for corn, and the land was productive and made the farmer profitable, that made the land more valuable. Well, I think around the time of the recession, a combination of things started happening, but probably the big thing was that ag, for one thing, got very profitable during the recession. For those of us who were living in communities that have, where ag is a big part of the economy, like here in Mankato, all through the Great Recession, we could have sat here going, what recession? Because, you know, we experienced a bit of some rockiness with the housing market here, but on the whole, everything looked fine because there's a huge presence of soybean processing in Mankato. So, you know, the corn market was going crazy because of the demand for ethanol, which is tied to the price of gas, which was high. And everything was looking really rosy. And when the recession started, you know, of course, everything crashed, the stock market, the housing market, commercial real estate market, everything where you could get a, you know, a fairly reliable return just was in the tank. And everybody was, you know, wondering, when are we ever going to recover from this, if we will? And so that one bright, shining little investment star out there was the ag economy. And people were looking at that going, oh, look, people are making good money here. That means if I bought some ag land, the person farming it would pay me rent, and they're making good money. So they'll keep paying rent, and I can make a decent, reliable return. The reliability was very important. And so everybody turned to ag land because that was the only thing that was still looking any good. And so that really drove the market from, you know, during the recession 2009 on up through 2013, 2014. And that's where it peaked, was in 2014. Because at that point, stuff happened and the ag economy crashed, the commodity prices crashed, everything crashed. And if you look at a chart of ag income, it goes right up in a big peak to about 2013, 2014, and then goes right off the cliff on the other side. But like you said, the ag land values didn't drop with it like they should have. They went down a little bit, but then they just went flat and they just stayed there, stayed pretty flat up until 2020, 2021. When the values started actually going up again, and now they're starting to talk about record territory. And so it's kind of complicated, but not terribly complicated. It's just, it looks like the ag land market got disconnected from the ag economy. And there are other forces at work now. There is a larger presence of non-farmers in what you would call in the property tax field, non-homesteaded ag land owners. So your, like your residence, your ag land can be homesteaded if you are the person that's actively farming it, or you're related to the person who's actively farming it and you live nearby. If you own the land but you don't live nearby, and you're not actively farming it in that you're, you know, renting it out to somebody you're not related to, then it's non-homesteaded. And that has an effect with different property tax rates, like it is residential. But with ag land, what that tells us is that there's getting to be a bigger and bigger presence of non-operator owners. And so it may have started out as, you know, the grandkids who've all moved to the cities inherited the farmland and now they're renting it out to people or something like that. But also we're finding now that more and more people from elsewhere are buying land just as an investment, and even investment companies are buying ag land as an investment. They have found that this seems to be a good return. And so this has kept the prices up. Also, overall, we have a decline in the number of acres that are in farmland. And, you know, it's been slowly decreasing over the last 20 years. And, you know, as the saying goes with land, they're not making more of it. And so as the supply of it goes down, even if the demand doesn't change, the price is naturally going to go up. But it appears like the demand has stayed up and the number of people selling stayed kind of tight for a while, but now there's more land coming on the market. And so that's working in kind of a circular effect where that's bringing in more buyers and whatnot. And so we're seeing more, you know, prices going up that way.
It's interesting because there seems to be a lot of different factors, some of them market induced, you know, kind of the free market type ideas, but also kind of on this end of it's a market that's heavily subsidized and propped up to some extent, right? Like we as a country and a lot of countries have decided that agriculture in general, we're going to try to shield it from extreme failure, extreme things happening, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, from a market standpoint, it seems like prices are going up because you have farmers that are saying, hey, I better buy this land because I'm in competition with people that don't even live here that want this land. So that's going to drive prices up. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, these investors coming in see ag land as a very reliable source of revenue and potential growth, maybe not huge growth, but slow growth. Mm-hmm. That they just see in the long term being a good investment. So you kind of have, while at the same time, they know, like, if the market does completely bottom out, we have government programs in place to make sure our farmers survive and can at least pay a bunch of their rent, right? To some extent.
Yeah, and not necessarily. I think the bigger influence over the long term, so after the farm crisis and the, you know, and the land value crash, the price bottomed out somewhere around $500-$600 an acre. But this was in 1987. It's been on a steady climb ever since then. And from the people I've talked to, who really know this field, it sounds like really what has been driving that long market from 1987 until about 2008 was the fact that interest rates have been getting lower and lower and lower. So if you look at a chart and if you tracked, you know, the rise in land value against interest rates, land value will be going up in a nice, you know, nice angle. And then interest rates at the same time are going down at a similar angle. And so basically you can buy more land for less money, you know, year after year after year. And so that has just made it easier to buy, you know, buy land overall. And this is the same influence that interest rate influence is what we've seen in the rise of the stock market and everything else. It's all because it's, you know, when you have very low interest rates like this and the cost of borrowing is low, it's what's called cheap money. And so people find it very easy to just, you know, borrow some money and go out and buy some land. And because of this cheap money, farmers have also been able to accumulate cash and put much more equity down when they purchase a piece of land. Part of what caused the farmland crash in the 80s was that they were being encouraged to borrow money with like 5% down on a piece of farmland. And so when you're spending, you know, borrowing $950,000 and putting, you know, maybe $50,000 down on $1 million piece of land, when the, you know, when the value of the land crashes and suddenly your land is worth, you know, $250,000 and you still own, you know, $900,000 on it, that's, you know, that's where the crisis is. So now there's just a lot more equity in land. But that was when land was still tied to the productivity of farmland. And so when we crossed that line into the recession, then an extra incentive was added to it that got other people's non-farmers' attention, you know, to say, oh, look, this is reliable. And like you said, part of that reliability was farming income was very high in 2012 and 2013. I'm just looking at a chart that I have here. And so government payments didn't factor in much, you know, at that point. But then the ag economy went off a cliff in 2014. And suddenly in 2015, government payments do start to have an impact on, you know, the total income of farmers. And you go to 2016 and 2016, 2017, 2018, ag income on average is almost zero. So government payments made it profitable. And then in 2019, ag income was actually negative. And so the government payments kept things afloat. And so this was a massive market signal that regardless of how profitable or unprofitable this piece of ag land is, that farmer is still always going to be able to pay rent because the government, those government programs are in place to keep that farmer stable and to keep that rental income reliable. And so that says to investors, this is a safe investment. It's basically backed by the government. And so we've seen that, you know, in 2017, when we started having all that trouble with, we put tariffs on Chinese products. And so China countered with an embargo or boycott of U.S. ag products, and the farm income, you know, went to nothing almost. And that, a big government program was put in place to keep farmers, you know, from going under. And then when COVID hit, the CFAP program, I don't remember what CFAP stands for, but it was basically, it's a government program to keep farmers whole while all this chaos is going on in the economy. And then we had the PPP loans that everybody else, you know, everybody's eligible for, and various supports like that. And so buying farmland is in essence like buying a government-backed bond practically, because it's insured. And so it's fascinating when you study supply and demand, you look at what goes into making these things attractive to buyers.
Yeah. It's interesting to put it in a framework of essentially a finite resource that has to get more productive and is also backed to make sure it doesn't completely fail. Right? I mean, it's like the perfect situation for an investor.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly.
You can't create land. There's going to be more and more people, so it has to be more productive.
Yeah. Well, and that leads to another, you know, point that, it's not super interesting, but prices do vary depending on, productivity does still matter. So where we're seeing the biggest increases in these ag land values are in the parts of Minnesota where land is the most productive. So especially Southwest Minnesota, but the whole Southern tier along Southern Minnesota and the Western tier of counties up to Canada, the prices there are higher than if you get into ag land, you know, in the interior of the state, except in the metro area, because there in the Twin Cities metro area, farmland in say Carver or Scott County or Dakota County, there's a whole different set of dynamics going on there. And that is because of the potential for development. And so if you look at the different counties where prices have been going up the most, they will be those Southwest counties, those far Western counties, you know, Lincoln, Otter Tail, Traverse, southern counties, but then also, you know, metro counties, Scott, Sherburn. I mean, Scott, well, Sherburn too. I don't think of that as being in the metro, but I guess it is. Yep. You know, Carver. And that's because they're sitting on the edge of development. And so one study from 2014, unlike the studies from 2008 and 2005 that were saying ag land value is tied to productivity, the study in 2014 was saying that's really not the case anymore. Productivity is a factor if you're not close to a population center. That's the value driver. If you're close to a population center, then the big value driver is that land's potential for being developed in the future. And so that's where another place where you see the values per acre going, you know, sky high too.
So Marnie, what does this mean for county revenues then and property taxes?
Yeah, when you look at a county's or a local government's tax base, that is basically the tax base is basically the potential amount of property taxes that could be derived from, based on the value, based on the estimated market value, which is where property taxes begin. Everything begins with the estimated market value. Then the county assessor goes through various stages of exclusions, deductions, credits, add-ons, referendum values, things like that, until they come to the net taxable capacity. And that is what's more commonly called the tax base. And so when you look at county tax bases for, in particular, Southwest Minnesota and in those regions like economic development region 6W and 8, those are counties like Rock and Lacqui-Parle and Swift and Jackson, the most ag dependent parts of the state. The values have really gone up like 200-300%. So we're talking about quadrupling in the last 20 years. Whereas the values in other parts of property tax, like commercial, industrial, residential, have risen, but not very high. You know, so it may be like residential may have gone up 30%, whereas ag land went up 300%. You know, commercial may have gone up 100%. But, you know, so whereas in, I think it's in region 6W, ag land went up from 59% of the tax base to almost 80% of the tax base, whereas the other pieces of the pie, you know, got smaller. And so that means that a lot of the property tax value is put on the shoulders, a lot of tax burden is on the shoulders of just a few landowners. And so that's when you start seeing issues of, you know, farmers aren't going to vote for referendums, you know, that would increase their property taxes because they're basically carrying the burden of most of those property taxes. And we should add that property taxes only make up about half of a local government's funding. The other half comes from what's called intergovernmental funds, which come from the state. But as one county administrator I talked to for this pointed out, those funds have been going down, you know, fairly steadily, at least for counties over the years. And so usually what happens is they'll kind of, you know, seesaw back and forth to kind of create a balance of property taxes and state funding for counties. But these rural counties where ag land values have gone up a lot, 20 years ago, intergovernmental funds would generally make up a little more of the pie than property taxes. But now property taxes are making up a bigger part of the pie than the state funds. And so That's one thing that we see as being an issue and possibly more of a problem than an idea, the idea that ag land could crash and suddenly most of the property tax base is wiped out. You know, that's a concern. And we can talk about what could cause something like that. But the concern right now is that the way the formulas are used to calculate state aid to local governments, they don't work for counties that have a lot of their property tax wealth concentrated in a few landowners and the population is going down. Because part of the formula is actually figuring out property tax value or property tax wealth, as it's called, per capita or per resident. And so your property tax wealth is, you know, as ag land is going up, it's not only making up a bigger share of property taxes, it's raising the whole tax base by a lot, you know, like 100 or 200% in some of these places. And so if your population is actually going down, then your wealth per capita may have gone up, you know, 300%. And that doesn't look good in the state aid formula because they're going, look at all that wealth per capita. But it's not taking into consideration that all of that wealth is coming from one source. And that source is shouldered by just a few residents.
Well, on top of that, too, is if we have more and more landowners that don't even live in the county, I think there's a lot of questions in around, is that wealth that's actually contained in the county or is that wealth being exported out of the county?
That's a whole other issue of, you know, that return on that investment is not staying in the county. It's not like grandpa owns the farm and he's renting it out to his son and grandson who live, you know, on the same property, you know, in the same section. It's somebody who may be living in New York, you know, collecting that return on investment from that property. And so that's, you know, another example of the ongoing issue of wealth derived locally and being exported out and not being returned to the local community.
So I guess the big story or the big question is, should counties be worried?
I think they're worried right now because they're seeing their state, you know, their funding from the state going down, you know, fairly steadily year over year. But yeah, I mean, there are the factors that could really, you know, cause a problem for ag land values. The big one is if interest rates rise. Now, what happened in the 1980s was because we were having runaway inflation and the economy was just in a hole because of, you know, people remember stagflation from the 70s. One of the first things that the Reagan administration did was have the Federal Reserve jack up interest rates really high just to bring everything, the inflation, to a screeching halt. And that worked, but that's also what, you know, was a big factor in the ag land value crash then because people stopped buying land and the demand crashed for it. So the scenario here is also this is being driven by very low interest rates. Now, the Federal Reserve is talking about raising interest rates this year, but they're not going to be like raising interest rates from, you know, 1% to 10%. It's going to be very small, very incremental changes to try and, you know, put a little friction under the inflation and slow it down. And so it may slow down the market for ag land some. But from the consensus seems to be that it's not going to cause a crash. You know, it may cause a slow decline, but there's not going to be a crash. So, you know, we don't have to worry too much on that end. If something happened to 1031 exchanges, which allow people who own investments in a, you know, in certain investments, especially land. It lets them basically exchange a piece of land that's appreciated a lot in value. So they would own a ton of capital gains taxes on it. Would let them exchange that for essentially the same type of investment for the same value, and then defer those capital gains taxes to a different time. If something happened to that program, that could have an effect because that's part of the driver. People who have land, especially around the metro area where it's appreciated a lot, are selling that land and trading it, doing a 1031 exchange in another part of Minnesota where they can get more land for the same amount of money. And so they'll come into a land auction with, you know, a good chunk of change, which allows them to drive up the price of land somewhat. And so to me, the real concern would be if something happened to the farm programs, you know, the federal farm programs, if suddenly someone, you know, in the majority in Congress got a burr in their saddle and said, we're going to end the farm programs. That could be a big problem because then the guaranteed profitability is gone. Now, that's probably not too likely, but, you know, there's a lot of government support right now. When COVID ends, some of those are going to go away. And so that could cause a hiccup in the market. But if something happened wholesale to government programs, then that would be a big problem because that profitability is gone. Or the assurance of profitability is gone, I should say.
So for counties, it's really kind of keeping an eye on what types of policy discourse is occurring, in, particularly at a federal level, in support of keeping the farm economy at least, if not profitable, at least break even to some extent.
And it's ongoing conversations with our state legislature to make them aware of the special dynamics that are going on in counties that are making the formula, the current funding formula, not work for them. This was the case for school districts where they were having a heck of a time, rural school districts, passing bonding referendums because, especially in, you know, high ag counties or school districts where a lot of the property value was tied up in ag land, the farmers were saying, you know, heck no, I'm not voting for that bonding referendum if that's going to drive my taxes up because, you know, I only represent, you know, 5% of the population. Why should I have to pay for, you know, the bulk of the property taxes? Well, after a lot of work, folks with, in particular with the our friends at the Minnesota Rural Education Association, they worked with the farm groups and the legislature to come to a compromise on bonding issues, on that bonding issue. So that now the state will step in and credit farmers 70% of that tax bill. It's going to 70%. It's been gradually moving up from 40% to 70% of that tax bill on bonding referendum. And that has made it possible for school districts to get bonding referendums passed so they can, you know, repair their dilapidated buildings and, you know, and build new schools and things like that. And so that has been a huge help because this is all still in an environment where, again, state funding has been gradually going away and for school districts, and school districts have been increasingly on dependent on their own tax base for their funding.
Yeah. And it seems like some of the conversations we've had regarding this is at what point do property owners, and in this case, ag landowners, start to fight back like they did with the school districts, and what they may have to start doing at the county level, we just don't know, you know, but at some point, are they going to be like, look, I'm covering half the bill
yeah.
for this entire county.
Yeah.
Is that the right thing?
There are some programs in place, like there's the Green Acres program, but that's more of a farmland preservation program that helps those farmers, especially around the metro area where their land values have really gone out of sight, to make it so they don't have to sell their farm to a developer because they can't afford their property taxes. For farmers, you know, everywhere, especially in ag areas, if your farmland is homesteaded, then you do get a homestead credit, and you're taxed at a lower rate than non-homestead. And you do get a similar homestead credit like you do if you're residential. But when your land, you know, your property type is making up 85% of the tax base, you know, it does, I'm sure, get to a point where, you know, certainly for school districts, they were finding, you know, farmers were saying, I'm not adding to my property tax, you know, because, you know, $200 addition to your property tax for someone in, you know, Jackson County or Swift County or Lacaparra County or Rock County looks very different from a $200 addition to your property tax bill in Carver County. You know, from there, they're like, what, $200? That's nothing. You know, whereas someplace else where the, you know, the average annual income is lower, they're going to go, yeah, $200 is quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Well, then you also get into all these philosophical questions about democracy and taxation without representation, and where landowners get to vote and not vote. And, you know, that plays in a role in this, because, you know, ag land doesn't abide by political jurisdictions or county jurisdictions, and you can own property in multiple counties, and but you only get to vote in one.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So, and the cabin owners would have something to say about that too. Yeah. Because this is kind of the same effect, not nearly as much, but that is kind of the same effect in, you know, in those north central counties where there are a lot of wealth in cabin property.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Marnie, thanks a lot for joining me and having this conversation. For anybody listening, the report will be out hopefully sometime in February. So be on the lookout for that. Otherwise, Marnie, thanks for the chat, and looking forward to reading the whole thing.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.